This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Human trafficking is an insidious and widespread problem in North Carolina. The exploitation of people for sex and for labor happens at a range of places, including illegal massage parlors, farms, restaurants, and construction sites. Over the past few years, law enforcement, academic experts, and nonprofit organizations have worked together, and they've been making significant progress, but there is still a lot that needs to be done. Today, we're going to talk about that on the State of Things. First, I want to bring Christy Croft into the conversation. She's Prevention Education Program Manager with the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault, or NCCASA. Christy, welcome. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about, the scope of this problem. I think when I hear human trafficking, I think of the sex trade, but it is much more widespread than that, is it not?
It is, and because my agency is the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault, most of my expertise and focus is on sexual violence that occurs in the context of trafficking, which can be sex trafficking and in the sex trade, but can also be one of the forms of violence that's used within labor trafficking to keep someone in their trafficking situation. And it can look like a whole lot of different things. The definition's pretty broad. For adults, the definition for sex and labor trafficking involves someone being in their work through force, fraud, or coercion. For minors who are being sex trafficked, you don't have to show force, fraud, or coercion because any minor in the sex trade is a victim or survivor of trafficking.
So talk about, is there some kind of profile in terms of how this system works and how people are brought into the system? You talked about coercion and violence. I'm sure that's essential to all of it. Mm-hmm. Is there a profile? Is there something that we're looking for in the way in which people are brought into this system?
Right. So there's definitely some common threads that can be present across all forms of trafficking. But the tricky thing about that definition being so broad is that it can look like a whole lot of different things. So for a long time, people, when they thought of trafficking, thought of that violence and organized crime and someone being physically restrained. And so a lot of our work has been sort of broadening that perspective to let people know it can look other ways. And we're doing a real good job of getting people engaged to understand that sometimes it can look, especially for what we call domestic minor sex trafficking, it can look like a young, vulnerable teenager who is in a romantic relationship, someone that they are viewing as a romantic partner who they don't realize is grooming them to have them engage in the sex trade at some point. And even though there may or may not be physical violence or coercion, there's this emotional manipulation with a vulnerable teen who wants belonging, wants love, wants acceptance, wants to be seen as special. Maybe they aren't getting that in their family life, their home life, their school. And now we're in this challenging place of trying to get people to stretch what that profile looks like even more to include some of the other ways it can happen, which, you know, with minor sex trafficking being any youth, any minor engaged in the sex trade, it can also look like two homeless queer or trans youth who are engaged in the sex trade because one of them says, this is not something I love doing, but this is how I'm surviving. I can connect you with a client who's been kind of nice if that helps. And while there's not an older exploiter in that situation, that still fits the definition of trafficking. And as we start to shift what that profile looks like when we think of trafficking, we have to start shifting how we understand and frame prevention too.
Well, and before we get to that, I want to say, you know, and obviously it's important for us to broaden our understanding so that we know what we're looking for. But then the question is, well, then how do we define human trafficking once it gets that broad? How do you define it?
How do we define it? There's a really good definition and an acronym that helps people remember, and it's AMP, A-M-P, which is act, means, and purpose. And so the act can be a number of things such as inducing, recruiting, transporting, holding, all sorts of things, a person through the means of force, fraud, or coercion. Anytime there's force, fraud, or coercion in a work situation, it's trafficking. For the purpose of either commercial sex or forced labor that profits or benefits someone else. And again, that definition for minor sex trafficking does not require force, fraud, or coercion.
I want to bring Samantha Floyd into the conversation now. She's a human trafficking consultant with the State Department and communication chair for the National Survivor Network. Samantha Floyd, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
Still with us is Christy Croft, who's Prevention Education Program Manager with the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault, or NCCASA. Samantha, tell us about some of the consulting that you do with the federal government. That's some fairly high level, sort of understanding of what's happening, which suggests that we need the federal government to pay attention to this, right?
Absolutely. The Human Trafficking Consultant Network for the State Department is actually a relatively new cohort of consultants. They went through a very intensive selection process, and we actually just started working together probably about 2 or 3 months ago, but it was several months in the making. And so some of the things that we're doing is looking at some of the funding that goes abroad and looking at those applications and making sure it fits within, looking at our survivors involved in how they're operating and how they're assessing their successes. Are they using trauma-informed methods? And are they being, client-centered in the way that they approach things? And so we find that, within any field, those are the most effective practices, where you have your clientele is informing whether you're succeeding, how your work is impacting them, and using that trauma-informed approach.
Well, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I want to see if I can understand that, because you're talking about the funding that is meant to check human trafficking, right? So you're saying, well, we're spending this money abroad. Let's make sure it's being spent wisely. So what are some of the things that we should be looking out for, and what are some of those best practices that we should use if we're going to create these programs?
Well, to me, the two really core is to be sure that you're using trauma-informed care so that you're not putting clients through unnecessary trauma as they're trying to get help. You're not re-exploiting them. And then incorporating survivor voices into the programming that you do. So you have people, maybe they're people that have come through your program, maybe they are survivors that are outside of your program, but the best practice is to have survivors involved at every level. Like, I'm thinking of doing a program. Let me talk to a survivor and see what they think of my ideas, what they would suggest that I incorporate. Then you get ready to implement the program. I have this workbook, can you come and help me develop this workbook? Can you help me develop this, group therapy model? And just involving them at every level of that. And then once you start rolling out your program, also involving them in how are we doing? Pulling your clientele, is what we're doing, is it benefiting you? Are you meeting your goals? Or is there anything that we're doing that is not helpful or that you feel is, causing you trauma or to not feel safe or to not feel, that you're in control of your healing?
Samantha, I know that you are a survivor yourself, and mm-hmm. maybe I'll ask you to talk a little bit about your story and how that would inform. I mean, how would take your story and help enforcement agencies and others come up with a better program?
Absolutely. So I was actually an adult victim of domestic trafficking. I was a single parent who lost my job and my vehicle broke down in the same week. So I had to move in with a family member to keep us housed. And it was a very unhealthy and volatile situation. And so while I was looking for employment, I was approached by what looked like a company with a lucrative, not unrealistic, but a lucrative sounding employment offer. So I went ahead and went through that application process. I provided my identification, my social security number, things like that you do when you're applying for a job. And then when I went to start this employment, I found out it was something very different, and that this agency was actually a false front for an organized crime run prostitution ring. So at that point, threats were levied against myself, my children, and family members to keep me from running away or exposing them. And so eventually I was trafficked through 11 states and 26 cities under this front. And eventually, some of the cities I would go through repeatedly, there were a couple of customers that I confided into that I was being controlled by someone else. And eventually one of those clients offered to hide me if I was ever able to get away. And so a few weeks later, I did run and felt safe hiding there because it was not a city I'd ever lived in. And felt like it was not a likely place to look for me. And so went and kind of hid out down in their guest room in the basement and went to the FBI.
So at that point, and you felt comfortable enough to go to the FBI and seek this kind of help?
I won't say comfortable. I was terrified for my life. And so I felt like going to them was the only way to find out how to protect myself.
Well, that must have taken, I can, yeah, that was the wrong word to use, because I can't imagine that you were comfortable. I can't imagine actually doing, anybody listening to that story say, well, you'd run for help. No, I wouldn't. I'd be so terrified because my family's involved. These people have very cleverly fooled me, and I don't know where they are. How did you, what was going through your mind that actually got you to the point that you sought that kind of law enforcement help?
Honestly, just pure terror. Yeah. I had tried to run away to a different city the first day, and they hacked my social media and were just putting like crazy things. They were texting me with threats. They were calling me with threats. And so I just shut down like all my electronics. I hopped in a car and I just drove. I cut off contact with everybody I knew for 3 days, which after my social media being hijacked, they actually thought someone had killed me already. And so it was just a matter of needing some kind of line or way of figuring out how do I get out of this? Because I've run now, but I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. And I didn't really understand human trafficking at that point. So I wasn't sure if I had committed any crimes in the course of my time under their control. And so it was part of it was a little bit of fear of, you know, not both staying alive, but also not ending up in jail myself.
Well, we're talking about human trafficking today from the perspective of community groups working to prevent trafficking. I want to bring Rick Hoffman into the conversation now. Rick's a retired major with the Raleigh Police Department. He founded Iris Training. He travels around the country to lead trainings about human trafficking prevention. And he joins us again on The State of Things. Rick, welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
Still with us is Samantha Floyd, human trafficking consultant with the State Department and communications chair with the National Survivor Network. Christy Croft is here as well, the prevention education program manager with the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Rick, talk about the challenges for law enforcement and because you got into this to really open the eyes of law enforcement to this very different challenge of enforcing laws against human trafficking.
So when I began, I really looked at trying to change the culture of how we look at sex trafficking, because not everyone engaged in prostitution is a trafficking victim, but we know that every trafficking victim is engaged in prostitution, and trying to separate who is engaged in prostitution and who is being prostituted. And so what we have found is that frequently law enforcement agencies will ask people during what they will dub as a human trafficking operation is, hey, are you a victim? Do you need help? And what Samantha just said, she didn't know what human trafficking was when she was being victimized. How are they supposed to self-identify and ask for help when you're threatening them with arrest? And so you're replacing one form of coercion from their trafficker, and then now you're giving them another form of coercion. Either you need to help me or I'm going to have to arrest you. And so that, you know, really was the start of a long journey for us to kind of think about how we start these cases and who really has the burden of being a victim. So a victim doesn't have to do anything for law enforcement. A victim is a victim based on what an offender does. And so putting this burden on a victim that you have to help me investigate this case, it was honestly the opposite. And generally what we do is, you know, and this is very common sexual assaults, is we question the credibility of the victim and make them prove that they're a victim before we initiate an investigation. And I just felt like that was the opposite way of starting these things. The other thing that I found is that we had a lot of expertise that was siloed in the way we assign work. We assign it based on the crime classification, and that just wasn't going to work. We were going to have to go find our victims, and we were going to have to focus on building trust. And so, you know, I know trust is a big topic with law enforcement and communities, but it's even more important that you do that when you are trying to identify victims, is to establish that unequivocal offer of assistance that is unconditional. Whether or not you help me with my case, I'm still going to offer you assistance.
Yeah, well, talk about, because you talked about this from the victim's point of view. Here you are essentially threatening them with another form of coercion. It's possible that you broke the law as I'm questioning you about what you've been through. But also talk about what happens up the chain through the process if the victim says, for a variety of reasons, chooses not to work with law enforcement out of fear, out of a lack of trust, out of concern that you may be arrested, and says, I don't need help. What does that mean up the chain of command when that crime gets in the investigation?
Well, I could tell you it's very difficult to say what will happen, you know, based on a very broad set of circumstances. But in general, throughout this country, what will happen is if you don't identify as a victim, you're going to be arrested or cited for some form of prostitution or whatever the offense is. And so that actually reinforces what the trafficker is telling a victim, which is that if first of all, the law enforcement is not going to help you. Secondly, they're going to arrest you. And then what you've done is you've reinforced that the trafficker is correct and pushed that victim back into the trafficker's strength, which is now you owe me money because I'm the person that bonded you out. I'm the only person that cares for you. I am really here for you. And you've made it more difficult for this victim to get services and get out of the situation, and you've actually reinforced what the trafficker has done. And so, you know, not only does that not work, it makes it worse.
Samantha Floyd, in your work now as a consultant and as an advocate now in the social work that you do, what kinds of stories have you heard that more or less confirm or not, what Rick is saying here?
Well, definitely what he hit on as far as building trust with law enforcement is a huge obstacle, because you look at the things that make people vulnerable to trafficking are things like poverty, natural disasters, immigration status, community options available to them, their family structure. So disproportionately, there are a lot of victims of human trafficking that are victims of color, victims that are not documented. And so we already have like a contentious background for law enforcement in those communities. So when you mix trafficking into that, it makes building that trust so much more difficult. And so I think that was just like a really, really key point to focus on. And also, even if you have someone who is an adult victim or a child who thinks that they're in trafficking of their own free will, when you start putting convictions behind them because they're not disclosing that they're a victim or they're not ready to accept the help that may or may not be offered to them, when they do that, this felony record that they walk forward with, or this, you know, in and out of juvenile detention facilities and things like that, that they're going to enter into college and things like that with, these records are then a huge burden that prevent them from really walking away from trafficking and being able to restart their life or build their life for the first time. Because they're not allowed to get housing, they're not going to get jobs, there are colleges that won't accept them now. So arresting people, whether you know they're a victim or not, you're really compounding and hindering them ever being able to get out of that.
Christy Croft, tell us about the way in which transgender and queer people in particular are targeted.
Yeah, well, one of the things is that any criminalization ends up having disproportionate impacts because, especially when you're looking at people who are transgender, who are also people of color, are facing multiple forms of discrimination and marginalization in their lives. They may have trouble having safe housing. They may not have access to housing. If they're young, they may have been rejected by their families. So when they do end up in these situations, and there's surveys that show that while like 1% of the U.S. adult female population has done sex work and engaged in the sex trade at some point in their life, the numbers in one of the surveys I saw was 11% of transgender people, 53% of Black transgender people, and over 30% of Latinx transgender people have engaged in the sex trade at some point. And this isn't because they're just more excited about the sex trade. It's because their options are more and more limited by structural oppression. And so they're in these situations where no one is taking care of them. They don't have access to protections. They're doing what they have to do to survive, and then ending up where they experience violence and can't come forward or don't feel like they can come forward because of some of the situations that Rick was talking about, where they're scared not only might they face even more discrimination from someone who might hold a bias, but they also are facing all these other biases Rick was talking about, where we want to get you to cooperate, prove that you're a victim. And it's just a very, very heavy weight to carry and a disproportionate impact.
Christy Croft is a prevention education program manager with the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Samantha Floyd is with us, human trafficking consultant at the State Department, communication chair for the National Survivor Network. Rick Hoffman is a retired major with the Raleigh Police Department who travels the country giving trainings on anti-human trafficking work. And if you believe you have information about trafficking, there's a hotline, 1-888-373-7888. It's at our website. website, stateofthings.org. If you believe you are know anything about trafficking or have been trafficked yourself, check out the website for the hotline. And our conversation on human trafficking continues on the State of Things in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about human trafficking today. Academics, nonprofits, law enforcement all learned to team up and tackle human trafficking in North Carolina, but there's a lot left to be done. Rick Hoffman's with us, retired major with the Raleigh Police Department, who leads trainings about human trafficking prevention. Samantha Floyd is a human trafficking consultant with the State Department, communication chair for the National Survivor Network, and Christy Croft is prevention education program manager with the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Rick, let's talk a little more about enforcement. You talked about, in the first place, not re-victimizing a victim, but then there's a question of how to proceed with the investigation. What are some of the other tips that you help law enforcement with?
So one of the things that's really difficult and challenging is to really synthesize that this is about exploitation. And so frequently law enforcement, when you gather evidence, you're gathering evidence of injuries, gathering evidence of crimes such as drugs, are tangible things that you can collect and you can identify that go to proving the elements of a crime. But when you're talking about exploitation, you're talking about a person's living circumstances. You're talking about what their vulnerabilities are. You're talking about coercion, which can be very subtle. And so, you know, we frequently will brief for a search warrant, and you may have new investigators that are assigned to search, like, a certain area of a massage parlor. Well, we don't tell them, or I don't think we do a good enough job, is trying to document what evidence of exploitation looks like, what your living circumstances are, so that you can prove that this is not voluntary, that this person's being exploited for the purpose of involuntary servitude. And those things are a lot less tangible. And so if you're not, you don't have subtle knowledge of, say, for instance, a figurine that might contain a sword that's oriented in the wrong direction, of how a person of that culture, and having the cultural humility to ask that person what that means to them and document it and photograph that, that's a lot more difficult and a lot more nuanced than frequently law enforcement gets trained in.
Yeah, and I would think, and again, there's always this question of volition, right? Did you agree to this? And in many cases, there is, at some point along the chain, an agreement, a yes to this. So that becomes an even deeper challenge, it would seem, for law enforcement to say that yes was coerced. Where's to find the evidence for that?
Absolutely. But it's not just for law enforcement. It's frequently for the victim themselves, mm-hmm. because they feel like they made choices. So they'll blame themselves for their choices without realizing that those choices were manipulated and coerced so that you were given a binary choice. And now you blame yourself or feel like you're responsible for your circumstances. And so you might not self-identify for that reason. But this is correct.
And Samantha, it seems to me that on the one hand, maybe there was no coercion in the initial agreement, but then it builds in afterward and you're exceptionally vulnerable because, again, going back to your example, you've given them passport information, social security information about your children. Tell us more about that, kind of what happens after, how the coercion may build in after the fact.
Well, I mean, definitely the more that they can get on the front end before your radar is up, the stronger they're going to be able to exercise that control when you do start realizing, like, oh, this is not a good situation. I need to figure out how to get out of this. So that's why you have things like the grooming. That's why you have the false employment fronts, because if they can, on that front end, get a lot of personal information that they can use to control you, they're going to be in a very good position to do that after the fact. But with human trafficking, and that's another part of where the education comes in, even if I had initially agreed to do what they were going to be asking me to do, I am, you know, if my freedom to make that choice changes during that circumstance, I'm still a victim of human trafficking. So, I mean, you have some people where they initially, you know, have someone like, oh, if you love me, you'll do this. And even though that was a coerced choice, some people do feel like they had that choice. Or, you know, we have to pay the rent, or your child needs food. And so they think they go into this choosing to do it, but then they get into it and they're like, oh, this is not what I want to do it. And then the force comes in and then the threats come in. So they're still a victim of trafficking if that choice changes after the fact. Them being held into it and made to stay in it
Yeah, and Rick Hoffman pointed something else out here, too, which is the kind of some cultural differences, which gets back to something you said. We need to be consulting with and talking more with victims to understand what some of the cultural differences are, what some of these things might have meant in a Korean culture or in other cultures, a Latinx culture, that maybe the police department didn't recognize. But that means talking to victims, right?
Absolutely.
I want to bring
you know, and law enforcement training across the board. I coordinate a task force in Kentucky as well, on a volunteer basis, and so we have like great training at the state level. But to get that training to trickle down to our local city and county law enforcement offices, that's not something that's always funded. And so getting like a cohesive education that is trauma-informed and survivor-informed and victim-centered is not the easiest thing to do for all of these smaller offices.
Can I make a point here?
Yeah, right.
So one of the things that I'm glad Samantha brought that up, because I think we have sometimes a top-down approach, you know, with federal agencies' involvement, and not a bottom-up approach. There are about 13,500 FBI agents. There are about 6,500 HSI agents in this country. There are 750,000 state and locals. You have a much – they're going to have the first contact frequently with some of these victims. They're closer to the ground identifying them, but if they're not doing a good job, it's very easy for them to marginalize or push these things away and not identify them effectively and not have specialized training and not know who to access. And I think there's a lot of work and a lot of opportunities that still exist here engaging them more effectively.
Yeah, it seems interesting. It's like you need both. You need everybody on the ground at the granular level, at the local level, to be well-trained and on the lookout. But then you'd want somebody with a bird's-eye view to bring all of these resources together. So at the federal level, you really want people to be able to coordinate at the highest levels while what you're coordinating is well-trained and ready to go. I want to bring another voice in to the conversation now. Margaret Henderson is a lecturer and researcher at UNC School of Government. And Margaret, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Let's talk about some of the things we look for. Again, Rick was talking about a little bit on the enforcement side, and you've identified, many expected groups of people who can help identify unexpected groups. We expect law enforcement to do this. Nonprofits may do it. But you've identified very unexpected groups who are very close to the situation, and if they're trained, can spot this kind of thing. Tell us more.
Yes. The National Human Trafficking Hotline collected data over many, many years, and the Polaris Project, which is an affiliated organization, categorized all of those calls into 25 different business models of sex and labor trafficking. So along with a colleague from Project No Rest, we did some focus groups with local government staff, and we went down that list of the 25 business models and said, if this was happening, who in city or county government would have eyes on it for some reason? And we found out that local government staff would be in a position to see 19 of the 25 different business models of trafficking.
How so? And who are those agencies?
Well, it's as random as the people who pick up the garbage and recycling might be the only people who see a young woman held in domestic servitude, for example. Or the librarians work with all kinds of vulnerable populations, and people come in there to apply for jobs. So somebody might ask them to help them apply for a job that is simply one of those jobs that's too good to be true. It's the modeling career or music career or acting career that is just a lure for other business.
And inspectors too, right?
Absolutely. Environmental health inspectors and actually fire marshals and fire inspectors are top on my list of professional groups I want to reach.
Give us an example of how this might work or how it has worked.
Well, environmental health inspectors are the people who go in and check where food is prepared or, you know, the water safety in an area. So they go in the back of restaurants, for example. And they're in a position to see labor trafficking, and they have seen indicators of labor trafficking.
Like what? What would they have seen that we might have missed?
Everything from bunk beds in the storage room, indications that people are, their personal items are there, clothes drying on the dumpster out back. They have the stories. So when I'm doing this human trafficking 101 kind of thing that I do to build awareness, I get a new story every time I go out.
There was a good example, too, right here in Durham of an illegal massage parlor, mm-hmm. and that's probably a pretty good example of what you're talking about. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the my understanding about that is that people became aware of who the owners were and that they worked in other states and that it was an illicit business. I am not informed of how they became aware of that situation. I do know in the big Florida case, the person who came in initially was an inspector, and saw the indicators that people were living there, and there was the proverbial 50-pound bag of rice, which meant that people were eating there, too. They were not leaving the premises, and that provided enough initial information to begin the investigation.
And you've also put your finger on another part of this problem, which is that it is not all sex work, that that workers are being trafficked in construction, in the hospitality industry. Tell us more about, and farms as well. Mm-hmm. And again, farm inspections, sadly, we are making things, farm inspections, unfortunately, less robust now for our visiting workers than it used to be, which means it will be mm-hmm. even easier in our state for trafficking, which is a sad turn of events. But tell us more about some of the other industries where this is and how these challenges are being approached.
Well, bear in mind that traffickers are predators, pure and simple, so they're good at figuring out how people are vulnerable. And certainly one vulnerability might be represented by my citizenship status or how long I've been in an area and how well I know that area. Another vulnerability might relate to how physically isolated I am, such as on a farm, or, you know, maybe I'm moving through on a Christmas tree farm crew, cutting Christmas mm-hmm. trees in the right. mountains, and I'm in isolated places, I'm controlled by the person who's moving us around, and I'm vulnerable.
Right, and again, hard to track.
It's absolutely.
You know, and you can't really leave your group very easily, right, to go to a local law enforcement agency, then, and you might only be there for a week or so. So
I might not know where I am.
Christy, mm-hmm. let's take a look at some of the ways in which this is being tackled. Cumberland County has taken a fairly creative approach, we think. Talk about what's going on down there.
So I don't know a whole lot about the specifics of how they're doing it, but there are a lot of places where they're looking at doing special courts so that when people come in, whether they are being trafficked or whether we're just recognizing that maybe they're in that gray area of consent where they're doing sex trade because they don't have options. And so in some of these courts, what they're doing when they find someone, pick them up on a prostitution charge, is they offer them services and say, hey, you know, are you being trafficked? Is someone coercing you? Let's kind of help explain this to you. Let's provide you services. Do you need somewhere to stay? Do you need job training? And they come up with structures in which people can complete services and follow a guideline and get the charges either dismissed or expunged. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it does try to help remedy that problem Samantha mentioned earlier about how those criminal charges then follow you and make it close to impossible for you to get out of whatever situation you're in, whether it's a trafficking situation or choosing sex trade because you really are experiencing so many forms of oppression and marginalization that you don't feel like you have other options. So it's a way to give options and redirect people out of the criminal justice system.
And Rick Hoffman, I guess that raises the question, too. It's one thing to train law enforcement officers what to look for, how to get the evidence, but that does suggest that district attorneys, courts, judges, all of them may have to take a very different view of what's going on here. Right?
I couldn't agree anymore, but it's not just that. I would widen it to bail bonds, the way the bonds are handled, the magistrates that are handling domestic violence court. And what Christy is describing is something that's been in practice in North Carolina for a long time. We do it with drug courts. The point isn't to basically prosecute and criminalize your drug dependency. The point is to get you to stop using drugs so that you can then, you know, have your life back. And so it's no different because we have a lot of vacator statutes to get rid of those criminal charges, but it's very difficult to get to. And you wonder why they're needed if we'd done this in the first place.
Margaret Henderson, are there many examples across the country of places where you think this is being done right, models that we could learn from?
Oh, I think there are good models popping up all over the country, and nobody has it all entirely right. But if we can keep communicating with each other and tracking what's popping up on the radar screen, I think we stand a good chance of replicating programs here. It's really important to point out that while a few communities in North Carolina, and I would say Cumberland County is certainly one of them, they chose to see the problem. They chose to create resources for these folks. We all have that choice. But right now, it's real inconsistent from community to community to community. And even law enforcement agency or across child protective workers, the awareness and willingness to see the problem for what it is not consistent.
Samantha, let me ask you, Samantha Floyd, obviously you're consulting with the State Department. You're trying to help the State Department oversee and account for the money it's spending on human trafficking abroad. But what about it? You talk about inconsistency in the United States. Internationally, let me ask you first, Are there examples of nations that are taking this more seriously and doing a better job in places where there's a lot of work on the other side that needs to be done?
As I said, I'm relatively, this is a relatively new consulting network. I really don't know that I am in a place to speak to that personally.
Rick, when you go around and do this kind of training, how long does it take you? Is it a hard sell? I mean, does it take you a long time to sort of get to the 101?
I honestly, yes, it's very difficult because they're fighting you. It's a cultural shift, and so it takes about 3 days to get there. And it's very difficult. But I will say this. One of the things I like to push is none of us all have all the resources we'd like to have, but I always believe that it's more important to be resourceful with the resources you have. And so I don't bring a lot of tools to those classes, but I am amazed by how effective and how committed they are when we do those things. And usually by the third day, not only can they make a case, but they've identified people that they want to follow up, and they've also seen the error of their ways. So they can identify somebody that everybody knows in this class, and I ask them to go back and look at that person 10 years ago and how those cases were treated and reflect on missed opportunities and then remember that as you move forward. And then usually the last thing I'll tell them is, do you want to make a difference or do you want to make an arrest? Frequently you make a difference making an arrest, but tonight you're going to have to choose which one's more important to you.
Rick Hoffman is a retired major with the Raleigh Police Department. He conducts anti-trafficking trainings. Margaret Henderson is a lecturer and researcher at UNC School of Government. Samantha Floyd, human trafficking consultant with the State Department and communications chair for the National Survivor Network. Christy Croft is prevention education program manager with the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I want to thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you believe you have any information about trafficking, you can call the National Human Trafficking Hotline. It's 888-373-7888. It's at our website, stateofthings.org, if you missed that. And you can call that number anytime. And you can find out more about our show at the website as well. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hull of Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.